national news from a grassroots perspective, you're listening to Groundwire.
Community news from coast to coast to coast.
Man, we could create jobs and we could generate money to put into the city's budget.
It needs to be addressed. Every year that we fail to address this, the problem gets worse. The chances for a total catastrophe get higher and higher.
And one of the senior editors said, the feminists are being very strident about this, which is always what they say when they don't like what feminists have to say.
Hello, and welcome to Groundwire.
This is Irene Jomo.
And I'm Alex Moore.
Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus Community Radio Association.
Today on the ground.
In the ongoing fight against climate change, Alberta environmental activists occupied the office of Federal Cabinet Minister Rona Ambrose, demanding action from the Harper government.
Former Afghan Member of Parliament and outspoken critic of the Karzai government and the NATO occupation, Malalai Joya, tours Canada.
We take a look at a new legal guide aimed at protecting First Nation water rights as the federal government claims legislation is underway.
And later in the show, we'll hear a report from the Good Green Jobs for All conference, bringing together over 500 participants from diverse communities in Toronto to build a movement towards economically and ecologically sustainable jobs.
And 20 years later, we remember the victims of the Montreal massacre, which killed 14 women in an act of anti-feminist violence at L'École Polytechnique. We'll hear original coverage from the Women's International News Gathering Service, WINGS, recorded in 1989.
That's all coming up on this edition of Groundwire.
Yeah, the headlines.
Environmental activists in Edmonton occupy the office of Labour Minister Rona Ambrose as part of a series of actions aimed to put pressure on government to take climate change seriously as UN climate change talks in Copenhagen are set to begin. Samantha Power has the story.
On November 23rd, a group of concerned citizens brought a halt to work at Conservative Environment Minister Jim Prentice's constituency office in Calgary. They remained in the office for over 7 hours, demanding that Prentice stop obstructing progress on international climate change agreements. The citizens were looking for Prentice to sign an agreement stating he would support a carbon emissions reduction program to bring emissions 25% below 1990 levels. Prentice spoke on the phone with activists occupying his office, but did not sign any agreement as he prepares for the Copenhagen Climate Summit happening December 6th. Again on November 30th, seven climate activists occupied Finance Minister Jim Flaherty's office. Activists called on Flaherty to push for a just, binding, and meaningful climate agreement in Copenhagen. And on November 25th, activists in Edmonton occupied Labour Minister Rona Ambrose's office with similar demands. Martin Tweedell is an activist who is part of the sit-in in Minister Ambrose's office. He describes these actions as an ad hoc coalition of citizens who have come together to demand Canada act for climate justice as the Copenhagen summit approaches.
We hope to alert the public in Alberta and in Edmonton in particular that this whole issue of climate change, greenhouse gases, extravagant use of fossil fuels, it needs to be addressed. Every year that we fail to address this, the problem gets worse. The chances for a total catastrophe get higher and higher. So we're hoping that by this action, people will see that some of us at least are taking this very, very seriously indeed, and perhaps that will inspire others who I know are concerned about it to come out and put pressure on the political leadership.
That was Martin Tweedell explaining the actions of activists occupying the offices of Conservative ministers as the Copenhagen climate talks approach. For Groundwire, I'm Samantha Power.
That was Alex Caldaro interviewing Martin Tweedell. Thanks to Samantha Power for that report. In the wake of controversial Afghan elections and Canadian government speculation on extending involvement in the war in Afghanistan, former Afghan Member of Parliament Malalai Joya brings her book on a tour across Canada. Joya's book, Women Among Warlords, The Extraordinary Story of an Afghan Who Dared to Raise Her Voice, is co-authored by Derek O'Keefe of the Canadian Peace Alliance. Her tour seeks to educate Canadians on media lies about Afghanistan and build towards an Afghanistan that is democratic and free from corruption. We go to Melissa Albiani for the story.
On November 21st, about 200 protesters gathered in a park outside an international military conference in Halifax to demand that Canada withdraw from Afghanistan and from NATO, the transatlantic alliance that is waging war in Afghanistan. Malalai Joya, a dissident member of the Afghanistan Parliament, highlights in her speech Canada's complicity in the Afghan war as a U.S. ally, a war which further destabilizes security and for whom the only profiteers are large corporations.
U.S. dropped 2,000-pound large Canadian-made bombs in my hometown in Afghanistan, which killed over 150 civilians, mainly women and children.
Shame!
The Western governments not only betray Afghan people, but their own people too. They are wasting taxpayer money in their soldiers' blood for a war which only safeguards the interest of the big corporations, and not only it did not defeat terrorists, but made them more powerful, and today the world is more dangerous than it was in 2001. No nation can liberate another nation. History has no such example. My people, throughout of their history, have fought for their independence, and now are in the verge of rising up against the U.S. and NATO.
Joya claims that democracy never comes by barrel of gun, by war, by cluster bomb. If his goal is democracy, President Obama has a responsibility to end the occupation and also bring President Bush to justice.
I think the policies of Obama administration in Afghanistan are no different from that of Bush. If he is against war, first of all, he must try to bring this criminal Bush to the International Criminal Court. Yes.
Thank you, Melissa Albiani of CKDU in Halifax, Malalai Joya, and Derek O'Keefe's book, Women Among Warlords, The Extraordinary Story of an Afghan Who Dared to Raise Her Voice, is now available. Linda Duncan, Member of Parliament for Edmonton Strathcona and Saskatchewan Law Professor Mary Ann Bowden, have just released their book, A Legal Guide to Aboriginal Drinking Water, A Prairie Perspective. The guide aims to provide basic legal information for First Nation and Métis communities to assist them in consultations with the federal government on pending safe drinking water law for Indigenous communities. The law will be tabled this year. Here is Linda Duncan.
On November 17th, the Auditor General report called attention to insufficient legal protection for Aboriginal groups from environmental threats, particularly their access to safe drinking water. NDP MP Linda Duncan released her new book, Providing Legal Guidance for Safe Drinking Water to Aboriginal Communities. Titled, A Legal Guide to Aboriginal Drinking Water, A Prairie Perspective, Duncan is hopeful the guide will assist Aboriginal communities in navigating a murky legal framework around water rights and security. Here's Linda Duncan speaking at the launch of her new book.
This is always the challenge in doing legal research and finding what people's real rights are and what the government obligations are. You may well have laws on the books, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's what's being applied in the field. And what we discovered was how incredibly different it is just between Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba in the way that the various government agencies are addressing this issue. The other thing that the book does is it isn't enough just to put in place in those communities, in the First Nation and Métis communities, similar kinds of standards that we have for non-First Nation communities. Because if the intent of the government is transfer over liability and responsibility to the First Nation communities to make sure that those standards are observed, that means that those communities are going to assume the liability for maintaining those standards. And what that means is we better make sure we're protecting the source water. And so what I've always looked at, it's not enough just to enact a law. We need to look at whether or not those resources are being deployed to actually train people and to have the field staff to go out and enforce that law and make sure that those protections are being delivered. The challenge that we have for federal law, is it going to be the responsibility of Indian Affairs? Is it going to be the responsibility of Health Canada? Is it going to be the responsibility of Environment Canada? And so it's this complicated morass. I don't envy any First Nation or Métis community trying to figure out, you know, what laws or policies or so forth are in place.
Harper's federal government has yet to deliver on new legislation regulating safe water delivery in Canada, but Duncan is hopeful her book will help guide First Nations and Métis communities through the existing legislation. For Groundwire, I'm Samantha Power.
That was Linda Duncan speaking on the legal guide she co-produced on supporting First Nation communities to advocate for safe drinking water. Thanks to CJSR in Edmonton for that story. We go now to this edition Community Radio Report.
CKMS, more recently known as Sound FM, the radio station based at the University of Waterloo, has suffered a major setback in its attempts to reestablish itself after a student referendum. Trevor Darlington has the story.
University of Waterloo students, in an undergraduate referendum held last month, rejected a bid from Sound FM, the UW campus station, for a $2.50 per term refundable fee. Sound FM, who had been receiving funding from UW students since 1977, was officially defunded by referendum in February 2008, severely crippling the radio station, who were greatly dependent on the $5.50 per term they had been receiving. Having no choice, the station was now run by volunteers who undertook an extensive rebranding and refocus of the organization. The priority? To make Sound FM student-run and aimed at students, attempting to counter campus concerns of far too much community involvement and influence at the station to merit continued student funding. Surviving off savings as well as economy-hampered advertising and fundraising efforts, Sound carried on, making it to UW's November 2009 referendum ballot with their plea for a new and reduced fee and the promise that things at Sound had changed. Sound FM Board of Directors President Steve Krysak.
The big thing was instituting block programming, which happened further down the line. That was something we had looked at, and it really guaranteed student space on the programming. And then the other idea of having a student be president of the board of directors we felt was a big change, because that meant there was always students on the board. How vocal they were, that's always up in the air, but having the president, the main spokesman for the radio station, to be a student was also a huge change in the station. A lot of the campaign was focused on the potential of what we had done so far with such few resources, and then imagine what we could do with the resources that would be given with this student levy that had been eventually shot down but had been proposed. So things like our live-to-air capabilities, having stuff, more events on campus, promoting on campus, bringing bands onto the campus. All these things were seen as potential of what we can do. And then also the idea of funding campus radio and funding that greater cause for the students.
Out of 25,534 eligible voters, all it took was 2,460 no votes from students to ensure that Sound FM would no longer be the official UW radio station, as they now were being forced, as per an agreement with the Federation of Students, to vacate their studios located on the North Campus. What made this all even harder to swallow for the 2,005 students who voted yes and the volunteers at Sound FM was the fact that the proposed fee was going to be completely refundable. Unlike before, Sound FM were even promising to offer the refunds on campus, a sticking point with the student body in the last referendum, who did not appreciate the long trip up to the Sound FM studios to collect their refunds.
Apathy is a big thing about why it failed. Why they said no, I've had people come up to me saying they didn't know what they were voting for. They just saw $2.50 and they didn't want to pay money. People who found out about our history afterwards, things like that, so they apologized to me for how they voted and things like that. So I think it was information, and whether you want to place the blame on the yes committee, the no committee, the Federation of Students, the radio station, whoever you want to place the blame, it was simply getting the information out there that people, A, didn't know there was a referendum happening, B, didn't know what the station was, and C, didn't know what the implications of this referendum would be for us and for them.
Having to come to grips with the referendum result, the Sound FM Board of Directors then had to make some very difficult decisions as to their future.
We had some preliminary offers, nothing that was concrete. There wasn't like pieces of paper passed off over to us, like sign here, the station's yours kind of thing. But we did have people express interest in purchasing, controlling interest in the station, purchasing the license, things like that. Those were avenues we looked at briefly, but we wanted to keep the station in the hands of its members how it is now. And we wanted to keep the station as close to this area as we could as well.
The result? Sound FM is not done yet. At a community meeting held on November 30th on the UW campus, Sound FM officially revealed that it will be setting up shop inside Maxwell's Music House, a local Waterloo performance venue.
We're very excited about this. We've had a couple meetings over the last couple weeks, and we're very excited about what this space can offer us. It is a much smaller space. We're no longer have the traditional style green room, the traditional office that we have, things like that. Recording studio is gone, but it offers us a lot of cross-promotional opportunity, links on websites, things like that. People are going to know I'm coming to play Maxwell's. I should also come to Sound FM. So there is a lot of opportunity for cross-collaboration and for growth with the two organizations.
For Groundwire, I'm Trevor Darlington.
Thanks for that report. Groundwire will be back after a short musical break. Stay tuned for more.
was Take and Take by Toronto's Lisa Bozikovic, whose debut album, Lost August, is being released this week.
You're listening to Groundwire. Groundwire is a bi-weekly, not-for-profit national news program produced from a community-minded perspective.
Groundwire is heard on dozens of campus and community radio stations across the country. We go now to this edition's feature stories.
On December 6th, communities across the country mourned the death of 14 women killed by Marc Lapin in Montreal this day in 1989, and the many women who have died victims of violent sins. On the 20th anniversary of the shooting, violence against women continues, and women continue to demand justice. We go now to original coverage of the Montreal massacre with report from Laura Yarros and Beth Blackmore.
On December 6, 1989, a gunman claiming his life had been ruined by feminists killed 14 women in the École Polytechnique, the University of Montreal's engineering school, and then shot himself.
The women inside the classroom, he asked or ordered the men to walk out of the classroom. Then he gathered the women in one side of the classroom and then shot six women there. He then went on the first floor into the cafeteria.
Marc Lapin, who was born Gamel Garbi in Algeria to an Algerian father and a Quebecois mother, came to Canada with his family at the age of 7. His father was abusive and violent toward him, his mother, and sister, and his parents were eventually divorced. He later adopted his mother's maiden name. As Lapin walked calmly through three floors of the engineering building shooting at women, he shouted, "I hate feminists, I want the women, and if I can't be an engineer, neither can you." Police later revealed that Lapin had previously applied to the engineering school. The Concordia University Women's Union, along with the Université de Montréal's Student Union, organized a candlelight vigil the evening after the shootings. Beth Blackmore of Radio Centreville's Matrix Collective was there.
Police estimated that there were 5,000 marchers carrying candles in the twilight, but media estimates were as high as 10,000. The march stopped outside the engineering school, where there was some tension for a few minutes when the first speaker, a woman from Concordia, a primarily Anglophone university, addressed the mostly French-speaking crowd in English. Then, when feminists tried to read a statement, they were stopped by a man from the U of M Student Union, who, in turn, was shouted at when he referred to those who had died using the masculine pronoun se instead of the feminine celle. Emotions were rising, but when another woman, also a U of M student from the Commerce Department, came out of the crowd to the megaphone and pleaded for unity, people put aside their differences and continued the vigil in silence, marching to St. Joseph's Oratory for a silent meditation.
Immediate public reaction was also, for the most part, split along gender lines. Most men, including journalists and politicians, said that this was an isolated act by a deranged personality. Most women expressed the belief that the killings were the result of society's tolerance of violence against women taken to the extreme. During the following days, however, the public began to understand the feminist position. Gazette reporter Mary Lamy.
There was a large news meeting. Everyone who was available, all of the senior editors were there, and one of the senior editors said, "The feminists are being very strident about this," which is always what they say when they don't like what feminists have to say. Well, I have a lot of connections in the women's community, and so I managed to get this job of phoning feminist communities across the country to find out the feminist analysis. I was quite determined to be logical and level-headed and to get interviews and get quotes that were really, really solid, so that it wouldn't sound like a bunch of women blowing off steam. I talked to women who were very intelligent and logical. 250,000 Gazette readers got to read a feminist analysis of the shooting.
Women in Montreal felt devastated by these events and expressed their anger, frustration, and grief both publicly and privately. Women engineers were asked to wear white scarves on December 11th, the day of the public funeral for 10 of the victims. Some Montreal feminists organized a women-only memorial held on December 13th, at which representatives of women's groups and individual women were invited to come up to the mic and express their feelings or read messages of solidarity. Women's groups in many cities held memorial services to honor the young women who died. Some women expressed the hope that this occurrence would not make us afraid to declare ourselves as feminists, but on the contrary, would serve to bring us together and strengthen our determination to continue the struggle. This is Laura Yarros and Beth Blackmore in Montreal.
That was Laura Yarros and Beth Blackmore of Radio Centreville Metric Collective in Montreal, featuring the music of Abigail LaPelle. Thanks also to Gianna Lorin and Frida Warden for bringing the special archive to Groundwire.
As this edition of Groundwire is released, the city of Copenhagen, Denmark is prepared to greet thousands of international guests for the 2009 United Nations Climate Change Conference. The conference runs December 7th through 18th. At its heart are talks among government leaders towards a new global treaty on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Environmentalists warn that if substantial cuts aren't made, the results will be catastrophic. From Toronto, Christian Schwartz brings us a report from a unique gathering of labor and community activists working towards a sustainable and equitable economy.
More than 550 people attended last month's Good Green Jobs for All conference held in Toronto, hosted by the Good Jobs for All Coalition. It was a lively and diverse gathering of union members and community activists, marked by a big turnout of youth from some of the city's low-income neighborhoods. The atmosphere was energetic and optimistic, despite the grim situation that working people are facing locally and across the country. Massive job loss, especially in the manufacturing sector, and growing poverty, particularly among racialized people. Against this backdrop, participants looked for ways to organize together for green government policies and secure healthy jobs with decent pay and benefits for all communities. NDP Member of Provincial Parliament and Energy and Environment critic Peter Tabbins set the stage for the day's discussions.
December 7th, 18th in Copenhagen, they'll be negotiating a world climate treaty. We want it to be a world treaty on green jobs, and people in this town should be out in public calling loud, making their voices heard. Green jobs globally, green jobs locally. I want you to look around, though, and look at the rest of the world. In the 1970s, when we had the big oil crisis, in Denmark, they looked at what their future was going to be. Were they going to be impoverished? They started the modern wind industry in this world. A country that's got the same population as the GTA, 20,000 people work in the wind industry. $6 billion a year industry. One-third of the world's turbine industry, one little country. Countries like Germany, you know, looking around, looked at this and said, we can learn from these people. And now, 250,000 people in Germany work in the renewable energy industry. Folks, Ohio. Toledo, Ohio has 6,000 people working in the solar industry. People who used to make the windshields for cars now make the glass for covering those solar panels. We can do that in Ontario. The province has brought in a bill to pay for renewable power. If you have a solar panel or a wind turbine, you have the right to sell into the power grid. So if cities and school boards were doing that, making public power, every municipal building, every subway building, every seniors building, every public garage, man, we could create jobs and we could generate money to put into the city's budget. And there are a number of councillors here who know what I'm talking about when it comes to money in the budget.
That was NDP MPP Peter Tabbins speaking at the Good Green Jobs for All conference in Toronto. Nigel Barif was the conference co-chair, and he's trying to bring the Good Green Jobs message to his neighborhood. An elementary school teacher, he's a member of Education Action Etobicoke North and is working with local parents and community members to press for the installation of solar panels on three school buildings in his area.
We believe that we can cut the energy bill for those schools almost in half, and at the same time put people in the local community to work and obviously improve the footprint, the ecological footprint of the community at the same time.
Keynote speaker Clayton Thomas Mueller of the Indigenous Environmental Network brought a national perspective to the conference. He testified to the disproportionate impact that climate change is having on First Nations and low-income working class and racialized people, and highlighted the tar sands developments in Alberta, which have destroyed vast tracts of land and poisoned communities while also distorting the Canadian economic and political system.
I can visualize a movement against tar sands that is led by Indigenous peoples in Alberta, in alliance with farmers, workers, and environmentalists, with people across the country acting in solidarity. This issue has traction, it's timely, and strategically, it is of the essence. We can't win on climate change without shutting down the tar sands, period. I'm sorry. And it's ironic that on the world stage, the colonial government of Canada presents itself as an emerging energy superpower, when in reality, it is all but a resource colony of the military superpower of the United States of America. And Canada has become a willing victim of the USA's insatiable need for a secure energy supply to support its auto-centered transit economy and global military domination. Now, from an Indigenous perspective, we understand the history of colonization, and we also foresee what lay ahead of Canada in this very precarious position.
Canada is facing much criticism coming into the United Nations Climate Change Conference, in great part because of its determination to continue extracting oil from the tar sands. Canada exceeded its 2007 greenhouse gas emissions target under the Kyoto Protocol by 34%. In the face of this political and economic juggernaut, Canadian environmentalists, labor, and community activists have their work cut out for them. This is Kristen Schwartz reporting for Groundwire from the Good Green Jobs for All conference in Toronto.
Thank you, Kristen Schwartz. You've been listening to a report from the Good Green Jobs for All conference in Toronto featuring NDP MP Peter Tabbins, conference co-chair Nigel Barriff, and keynote speaker Clayton Thomas Mueller of the Indigenous Environmental Network.
That's all for this edition of Groundwire. Tune in next time for more social justice, environmental, campus, and community news.
Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
All of our episodes are available for listening and podcasting at groundwire.ncra.ca. If you're interested in contributing as a journalist, sponsoring an edition of Groundwire, or sending in feedback, please get in touch with us by email at groundwire@ncra.ca.
This edition was produced by Tara Michelle Zinnick, Kyle Runicles, Alberto Lugo, and Carly Forbes, and anchored by Irene Jomo and Alex Moore at CFRU in Guelph.
We thank Trevor Darlington, Corey Schmidt, Samantha Power, Alex Caldaro, Melissa Albiani, Christine Schwartz, Laura Yaros, Beth Blackmore, Jana Lauren, and Frida Warden for their contribution to this edition.
The music featured in this edition was Toronto artist Lisa Bozikovic.
For their support, Groundwire thanks the Public Service Alliance of Canada. Think public. To learn more, visit www.psac.com.
We exit with music from Guelph Local's Weird Weather. This is A River Runs Through Her, off their album, Surface of the Moon.
This has been Irene Jomo
and Alex Moore.
From all of us at Groundwire, thanks for tuning in.
She sleeps like a giant, burnt out old relic left to fade. She lays there so quiet, a decay from her glory day. A secret divides her, a ray of light, the flawless darkness. Yeah, a river runs through her. Yeah, a river runs through her.